And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is March the 9th, 68th day of the year. 297 days remain till the year is over with. On this date in 141 BC, Liu Qi, posthumously known as the Emperor Wu of Han, assumes the throne over the Han Dynasty of China. In 1009 AD, first known monastery of Quedlinburg. 1226, Khwarazmian Sultan Jalal al-Din conquers the Georgian capital of Tbilisi. 1230, Bulgarian Tsar Ivan Atsen II defeats Theodore of Epirus in the Battle of Klokotnitsa for the Indies. The fleet will discover Brazil, which lies within the boundaries granted to Portugal in the Treaty of Tordesillas. 1701, Safavid troops retreat from Basra, ending a three-year occupation. 1765, after a campaign waged by the writer Voltaire, judges in Paris posthumously exonerate Jean Calais of murdering his son. Calais had been tortured and executed in 1762 on the charge, though his son may actually have committed suicide. 1776, The Wealth of Nations by Scottish economist and philosopher Adam Smith is published. I had to read that in college, hated it. 1796, Napoleon Bonaparte marries his first wife, Josephine de Beauharnais. 1811, Paraguayan forces defeat Manuel Belgrano at the Battle of Tacuary. 1815, Francis Arnolds describes the first battery-operated clock in the Philosophical Magazine. 1841, U.S. Supreme Court rules in the U.S. versus the Amistad case that captive Africans who had seized control of the ship carrying them had been taken into slavery illegally. 1842, Giuseppe Verdi's third opera, Nabucco, receives its premiere performance in Milan. Its success establishes Verdi as one of Italy's foremost opera composers. 1842, the first documented discovery of gold in California occurs at Rancho San Francisco, 6 years before the California Gold Rush took place. 1847, Mexican-American War, the first large-scale amphibious assault in U.S. history, is launched in the Siege of Veracruz. 1862, American Civil War, USS Monitor and the CSS Virginia fight to a draw in the Battle of Hampton Roads, the first battle between two ironclad warships. CSS Virginia was known as the Merrimack, and that's the battle between the Monitor and the Merrimack. In 1908, Inter Milan is founded on Football Club Internacional, following a schism with AC Milan. 1916, Mexican Revolution. Pancho Villa leads nearly 500 Mexican raiders in an attack on the border town of Columbus, New Mexico. 1933, Great Depression. President Roosevelt submits the Emergency Banking Act to Congress, the first of his New Deal policies. 1942, World War II, Dutch East Indies unconditionally surrendered to the Japanese forces in Kalahati, Subang, West Java, and the Japanese completed their Dutch East Indies campaign. 1944, World War II, Soviet Army planes attack Tallinn in Estonia. 1945, World War II, a coup d'etat by Japanese forces in French Indochina removes the French from power. Also in 1945, World War II, Allied forces carry out firebombing over Tokyo, destroying most of the capital and killing over 100,000 civilians. Now, a lot of the buildings in Tokyo were built of reinforced paper. 1946, Bolton Wanderers Stadium disaster at Burton Park, Bolton, England, kills 33 and injures hundreds more. 1954, McCarthyism. CBS TV broadcast the See It Now episode, a report on Senator Joseph McCarthy, produced by Fred Friendly, who was not overly friendly. Let me say this. 1956, Soviet forces suppress mass demonstrations in the Georgian SSR, reacting to Nikita Khrushchev's de-Stalinization policy. every leader after Stalin went out of his way to make Stalin look bad. 1957, the 8.6 Andrian off Islands earthquake shakes the Aleutian Islands, causing over 5 million in damage from ground movement, and also creates a destructive tsunami. 1959, the Barbie doll makes its debut at the American International Toy Fair in New York. 1960, Dr. Belding Hibbard Scribner implants for the first time a shunt he invented into a patient that allows the patient to receive hemodialysis on a regular basis. 1961, Sputnik 9 successfully launches, carrying a dog and a human dummy, and demonstrates that the Soviet Union was ready to begin human spaceflight, and that human dummy went on to be elected to Congress. 1967, Transworld Airlines Flight 553 crashes in a field in Concord Township in Ohio. That was after a mid-air collision with a Beechcraft Baron killed 26 people. 1974, the Mars 7 flyby bus releases the descent module too early, missing Mars completely. 1976, 42 people die in the Cavalese cable car disaster, the worst cable car accident to date. 1977, the Hanafi siege and a 39-hour standoff, armed Hanafi Muslims seize three Washington, D.C. buildings. 1978, President Suharto inaugurated Jagorawi Toll Road, the first toll highway in Indonesia. It connected Jakarta, Bogor, and Klawi in West Java. 1987, Chrysler announces its acquisition of American Motors Company. 1997, the comet Hale-Bopp. Observers in China, Mongolia, and eastern Siberia are treated to a rare double feature as an eclipse permits Hale-Bopp to be seen during the day. 1997, the notorious B.I.G. is murdered in L.A. after attending the Soul Train Music Awards. He's gunned down, leaving an after party at the Peterson Automotive Museum. His murder is still unsolved. And in 2011, Space Shuttle Discovery makes its final landing after 39 flights. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day, Catherine of Bologna. 40 Martyrs of Sebaste. Francis of Rome, Pacian. Pope Cyril VI of Alexandria in the Coptic Orthodox Church. Gregory of Nyssa in the Episcopal Church in the U.S. And Teacher's Day in Lebanon. Now, let's see what else we got. I know we got a bunch of other things that happen on this date. Okay, 1522, Martin Luther begins preaching his Invocavit sermons in the German city of Wittenberg, reminding citizens to trust God's word rather than violence, and thus helping bring to a close the revolutionary stage of the Reformation. 1918, the Russian Bolshevik Party becomes the Communist Party. 1933, Congress is called into special session by FDR. It begins what's known as the 100 Days. 1276, Augsburg becomes an imperial free city. 1496, the Jews are expelled from Carintha in Austria. 1497 was Nicolaus Copernicus's first recorded astronomical observation. 1551, Emperor Karel appoints his son Philip as heir to the throne. 1562, kissing in public is banned in Naples, Italy. In fact, it's punishable by death. 1566, David Rizzio, private secretary to Mary I of Scotland, is murdered in the palace of Holyrood House in Edinburgh, Scotland. In 1642, English Queen Henrietta Maria arrives in Helvoet Sluis in the Netherlands. In 1721, British Chancellor of the Exchequer, John Aislabel, is confined in the Tower of London. In 1741, the British fleet under Admiral Ogle begins an assault on Cartagena in the New World. In 1745, the bells for the first American carillon are shipped from England to Boston on this date. In 1798, Dr. George Balfour becomes the first naval surgeon in the U.S. Navy. In 1804, George Cadoudal, a Breton royalist who plotted to overthrow Napoleon in the Pichegru conspiracy, is arrested on this date. 1820, in the Philippines, the foreigners are chased out. About 125 people die in that little escapade. 1821, Charles Graham of New York is granted the first U.S. patent for artificial teeth. 1834, the French Foreign Legion is founded. Supposedly, if you're French, you can't serve in it. It's only for those who were not born in France. 1839, the Prussian government limits the work week for children to just 51 hours. 1856, Sigma Alpha Epsilon is founded in the Johnston Mansion House on the University of Alabama. 1858, Albert Potts of Philadelphia patents the street mailbox. On this date in 1861, U.S. Confederate currency is authorized, the $50 bill, the $100 bill, the $500, and the $1,000. On this day in 1864, Ulysses S. Grant's appointed commander of the Union Army. He had never succeeded at anything until he became, I think he bought his commission from a friend. In 1891, the Great Blizzard of 1891 begins in England and lasts till March 13th. Kills 200 people and 6,000 animals. Major League Baseball's Cleveland Spiders signed a man named Louis Soclexy, who was a full-blooded Penobscot, to play. So the Cleveland's fans started calling the team the Indians. In 1915, it was made official. 1898, Peter of Tarlantisi, Pope Innocent V, and he was not innocent by a long shot, is beatified as a saint in the Catholic Church by Pope Leo XIII, March 9th, 1898. 1907, the first involuntary sterilization laws enacted in Indiana. 1914, U.S. Senator Albert Fall, known for being involved in the Teapot Dome scandal, demanded Cubanization of Mexico. 1916, Germany declares war against Portugal. 1918, Ukrainian mobs massacre Jews of Saradino, Buda. 1923, the Amsterdam taxi strike ends. 1925, what was known as Pink's War, the first RAF operation conducted independently of the Army or the Navy, begins on this date. 1926, Bertha Landis is elected first woman mayor of Seattle. In 1932, the former Chinese Emperor Henry Puyi is installed as head of Manchuria. The Japanese put him in. He was their puppet ruler. On this date in 1935, Adolf Hitler publicly announces the creation of a new air force called the Luftwaffe. On this date in 1942, the construction of the Alaska Highway begins. And that firebombing of Tokyo I mentioned took place on this date in 1945. 334 U.S. B-29 superfortresses attacked Tokyo with 120,000 firebombs. Also on this date in 1945, the Japanese proclaim independence of Indochina. In 1950, the immortal Willie Sutton robs Manufacturers Bank of $64,000 in New York City. In 1951, physicist Edward Teller and Stanislaw Ulam submit a classified paper to Los Alamos Lab. In that paper, they propose their revolutionary new design called Stage Implosion for a practical megaton range hydrogen bomb. 1953, on this date, Joseph Stalin's funeral is held in Moscow after 4 days of national mourning. 1954, Edward R. Murrah criticizes Senator Joseph McCarthy. 1956, Archbishop Makarios of Cyprus is arrested and exiled to the Seychelles Islands. In 1959, the first known radar contact is made with Venus on this date. 1961, a mine cave in Japan killed 72 miners. 1962, Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser declares Gaza belongs to Palestinians. This day in 1964, the first Ford Mustang is produced. 1971, three off-duty Scottish soldiers are killed by the Provisional Irish Republican Army. 4,000 shipyard workers take to the streets to demand internment in response. 1972, four members of the Irish Republican Army, not the Provisional, but the real one, down a premature explosion at a house on Clonard Street in Lower Falls, Belfast. On this day in 1974, the last Japanese soldier, a guerrilla operating in the Philippines, surrenders 29 years after World War II ended. He said he didn't get the newspaper. 1975, construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System begins. 1979, on this date, Major League Baseball Commissioner Bowie Kuhn orders baseball to give equal access to female reporters right into the dressing room. 1983, Zimbabwe opposition leader Joshua Nkomo flees to Botswana. In 1986, NASA announces searchers found the remains of the Challenger astronauts who were killed when the shuttle self-destructed. In 1989, on this date, Eastern Airlines files for bankruptcy. Also in 1989, the Senate rejects President George H.W. Bush's nomination of John Tower as Defense Secretary. In 1996, NASA Space Shuttle STS-75, that was Columbia 19, successfully lands. In 2006, liquid water is discovered on Enceladus, the sixth largest moon of Saturn. In 2007, the Justice Department released an internal audit that found that the FBI had acted illegally in its use of the Patriot Act to secretly obtain personal information about U.S. citizens. Well, in 2012, senior members of a hacking group called LoseSec are arrested, including one member of the FBI. In the U.S., the United Kingdom, and Ireland. In 2015, U.S. President Barack Amagad Obama signs an executive order declaring Venezuela a national security threat to the U.S. Everybody ignored it, but he signed it. 2016, EU migrant crisis. Macedonia, Croatia, and Slovenia close their borders to migrants trying to reach northern Europe. On this day in 2020, Italy announces it's locking down the whole country due to a spike in COVID-19 cases. They had 10,040 cases and 630 deaths. Well, let's see. Well, I think we've come to the end of our little history segment. You know, we've been doing a lot of talking lately about unsolved murders in Hollywood. And certainly, there's a lot of them. Now, for the most part, it is true that in general, people worship celebrity. But it's not always warranted. One of the most popular TV stars of the 50s was a man named George Reeves. He played Superman. And depending on who you talk to, it was either suicide or murder. Now, the suspects were Eddie Mannix, who was the big shot at executive VP at one of the major studios, and his wife, Toni. Toni was having an affair with George Reeves. Now, Reeves was born January 5th, 1914. He was born George Kiefer Brewer. And he's born about as far from the glitz and glamour of Hollywood as you can get. Woolstock, Iowa. Now, his parents got a divorce shortly after he was born. His Newly divorced mother packed up George and moved him to Galesburg, Illinois. Now, their life there would only last a few years before George's mother decided to head for California. And in California, she wound up marrying a guy named Frank Joseph Bacello in 1920. So George became Frank's stepson, and after the marriage, he was called George Bacello, or Basolo. Well, George liked California well enough and actively participated in theater in school. Now, 15 years later, his mother divorced Frank. George is out of town at the time, so the divorce was done secretly and very quietly. And his mother lied to him and told George that Frank killed himself, and George believed her for a long time. Now, this would become an ominous omen of George's life, since, at least according to the traditional story, George is also supposed to have committed suicide. At any rate, he grew up and graduated from high school and went on to continue his studies in theater at the local community college in Pasadena. His first big break in Hollywood came when he was given a small part in a 1939 film, Gone with the Wind. He played one of a set of brothers who was romancing Scarlett. Now, after that film ended, George went on to pursue several bit parts in various theatrical productions, including piece called Pancho. It was in this role that saw him recruited by the Warner Brothers Film Company. It was upon getting signed with Warner Brothers, George was told he needed a more fan-friendly name than Basolo. So he adopted the last name of Reeves, which he used for all future productions. Now, he would play roles in several mediocre films over the next few years for Warner Brothers, but none of them really got him the big break he needed. World War II broke out. 1943 put his acting career on hold when he was recruited by the U.S. Air Force. Well, after the war, he came back to civilian life, and it was hard for him to get back into the swing of things in Hollywood. That's when he became involved with a woman named Toni Max, and everything changed. She was actually the wife of MGM mogul Eddie Mannix. Now, Toni liked George and helped him find work. And, not surprisingly, she struck up a romantic relationship with the star. Soffer said the relationship was an open secret, and apparently Eddie approved of it. I mean, Eddie himself had several mistresses and apparently obliged his wife so that she could have some lovers on the side as well. At any rate, it was through these new connections that George eventually came to play Superman in the TV pilot entitled Superman and the Mole Man. And this TV debut led Reeves to star in the eventual Superman TV series. Now, this part and this work was a major boost for Reeves at first. But after the first few years, he began to grow frustrated at what he saw as low pay, and in fact, he became typecast in that one role. Now, he began to feel that he was at a dead end. And, many people when they get a successful part, in either, usually in TV, they see themselves as destined for great things in the movies. Whether that's actually true or not, now, he felt he'd never be famous for anything other than being TV Superman. Well, thanks to some behind-the-scenes maneuvering, he eventually got a suitable pay increase, and things started to look up. In 1957, he was even optioned for a potential Superman film for the big screen, Superman and the Secret Planet. Well, things were going pretty well, but in 1958... he broke off his relationship with Toni Mannix, became engaged to a woman named Lenore Lemon. Well, apparently, Toni was not too happy with these developments, and the next year, George was dead. Now, it was June 16th, 1959,
George was found dead in his bedroom with what seemed to be a self-inflicted gunshot wound. He had a number of guests in the house at the time, and they were drinking and hanging out when it was alleged by more than one they heard the gunshot. William Bliss, one of the guests, ran up and found George laying on his bed, naked with a gunshot wound to the head. And shortly after that, after everybody got their story straight, they called the police. Now, the investigators, naturally, seemed to view George Reeves' death as an open-and-shut case of suicide. But there are actually more questions than there are answers. First of all, the abruptness of the alleged suicide is odd. Now, it is true, Reeves was frustrated with his career and he feared being typecast as Superman. But at least he was working and making money, so was this really enough of a reason for him to suddenly, out of nowhere, commit suicide? Trying to turn his career around, after all, and besides all that, he had just begun a happy engagement to the woman he loved. So would he throw it all away in a brief moment of melancholy sadness? This didn't seem to add up to the George Reeves that everybody knew. And another aspect that some later investigators noted is that Toni Mannix was clearly enraged when George Reeves ended their relationship. She's supposed to have said, and a number of people testified to this, "I made you and I can break you." She was the one who made George famous, and she felt betrayed. He had cut her off to marry someone else. Now, of course, she couldn't marry him herself because she was already married to Eddie Mannix. And her husband, Eddie, was a powerful guy and said to have plenty of underworld connections with the mob. So it's been suggested that Eddie, angry that George had upset his wife, sent a mobster to take him out and make it look like suicide. I mean, the theory's a little odd, I'd have to say. I mean, how often does a guy have a man killed because he isn't having an affair with his wife? Just didn't make any sense. But on the other hand, Toni and Eddie Mannix were not your average couple. They had an open marriage before such a thing was popular. They also had a lot of secrets. And Eddie was known as a Hollywood fixer. He could fix anything. Maybe he fixed George Reeves for good, for making his wife upset. Although the rest of the world put George Reeves' death out of their mind within weeks of its occurrence, among George's inner circle in Hollywood, there was always rumors that there was foul play. And most of these rumors centered around Toni and Eddie Mannix. Interestingly, Reeves wasn't the only Hollywood murder Eddie Mannix was accused of being involved in. It's been suggested when starlet Jean Harlow's screenwriter husband Paul Byrne died of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot wound, it was actually a hit. And that hit was ordered by none other than Eddie Mannix. So, we've got two sketchy suicides in which Eddie Mannix was suspected of being involved. Now, this, of course, is nothing but unproven speculation, but the gossip just wouldn't die. And it was on Toni's deathbed, in fact, she supposedly, according to those who were present, made a last-minute confession of her involvement. In 1999, a Hollywood publicist by the name of Edward Losey claimed that he was at Toni's side when she passed away, and he was a witness to her telling a priest she had indeed sent a hitman to get George Reeves. According to Edward, he chose to come forward in 1999 because that was the year that the last of the thugs of that worked for Eddie Mannix died, which cleared the way for disclosure. And the reason that Toni confessed to a priest before dying? Well, according to Losey, the answer to that was very simple. She was terrified of going to hell for some of the things she had done. And even if any of this is to be believed, this general explanation of who snuck into George Reeves' room that night to kill him. Now, there have been a number of suggestions that maybe William Bliss, the guy that gone up to check on him on the night of his death, may actually have been the trigger man. The whole crowd downstairs was drunk, and so it raised the possibility of all of them being duped into thinking that William went up to check on George after the gunshot when he ran up there before the gun ran off and killed him. There's also the possibility they were scared into concocting that story so that they didn't fall victim to mob vengeance. In fact, Reeves' own fiancée, Lenore Lemonen, toward the end of her own life, admitted that parts of her police testimony had been scripted and coached by Bliss. In the end, though, we'll probably never really know the truth of what happened to Superman that night. It was officially ruled a suicide, but there was actually never any real investigation into that case. And a number of people who had gained entry to Reeves' home after his death reported having caught glimpses of him in a mirror looking at him while wearing his Superman outfit. Some things just don't die. Well, our next one is a strange case. It's been a well-known Hollywood murder mystery since 1922. The man's name was William Desmond Taylor, and he died in Los Angeles, California. Number of suspects, who at that time were all well-known stars, Edward Sands, Mabel Normand, Mary Miles Mintner, it was never solved. In fact, the investigation was nipped in the bud by none other than the movie studio. Now, William Desmond Taylor was a Hollywood pioneer. Born in Ireland on April 26, 1872. Moved to the U.S. in 1891. Got his start in New York. Married a woman and actually had a child. But he ran out on his family shortly after the child's birth and made his way to California, where he showed up in 1912. Moved away from acting in favor of producing and directing instead. The first film he personally directed was 1914's The Judge's Wife for Balboa. In 1915, he began working for famous players Lasky, which had originally been known as Palace Pictures. This company had become the main outlet for Williams' work, and besides a brief absence while he served in World War I, he produced a steady stream of films with famous players that made them a steady stream of money. Now, in these films would appear some of the biggest actors of the time, Dustin Farnham, Mary Pickford. But 1920 also had a successful trilogy on his hands based on Mark Twain's classic novel Huckleberry Finn. It's also around that time he began directing a promising young starlet by the name of Mary Miles Mintner. He oversaw the production of the hit movie Anne of Green Gables, in which she starred. Well, it was while Taylor was riding high in Hollywood that he was finally tracked down by the wife and child he'd left behind in New York. In fact, his daughter Daisy began to write to him. And he wrote back and agreed to meet with his daughter July 21st, 1921. And by all accounts, the reunion was a pleasant one, and it was said they enjoyed each other's company. But yes, less than a year later, though, William Desmond Taylor would be murdered. Now, he was found dead February 2nd, 1922. His corpse was discovered at his personal residence in L.A. Curious locals gathered, and word got out that Mr. Taylor was dead. Seemingly out of nowhere, a man appeared on the scene claiming he was a physician. And he looked William over and claimed he died of a bleeding stomach. Well, shortly after this, the mysterious physician left and was never seen again. Nobody knew who he was. But it was discovered that his pronouncement was somewhat in error. William Desmond Taylor had been shot in the back. Well, at the outset of the murder, investigators had a difficult time establishing a motive. Didn't seem to be theft, since all of his money and valuables were left undisturbed. Now, there were plenty of clues on the scene, but due to a lack of modern forensics and sloppiness on the part of investigators, no solid lead was ever established, and the crime remained unsolved. There was plenty of suspicious activity, though. When investigators first arrived on the scene, it was said they noticed a couple of big wig execs from Paramount tossing paperwork into a burning fireplace. And there was Mabel Normand, a silent scream comedian who seemed to be frantically searching for something. Now, the other odd thing about the case was the way Desmond appeared to have been neatly put into position by the killer. He's laid flat on his back, his clothing straightened up, his arms placed at his side. Absolutely no sign of trauma, though some thought he died of a medical issue. Went until the corpse was turned over, it was discovered he'd been shot. As the investigation heated up, Taylor's home was thoroughly searched. And from what was found, it soon clear William Desmond Taylor lived a double life. Aside from the austere public image he cultivated as a professional director, a number of nude photos were found of Desmond in compromising position with the various female actresses from his films. It was also the discovery of a mysterious locked closet. And when it was opened, it was full of women's lingerie. Now, the articles of clothing were apparently tagged with initials and a date indicating who they were from and when he acquired them during his sexcapades. Along with lingerie, there was also a nightgown that belonged to Mary Miles Mintner, complete with her initials on the gown, MMM. Now, Mary Miles Mintner and William Desmond Taylor were close at the time of his death, and some would eventually suggest that she was close enough to be the killer. They also found a pink perfume-drenched note from Mary Miles Mintner in which she proclaimed her undying love for Desmond. It said, "Dearest, I love you, I love you, I love you. Yours always, Mary." Well, despite several such outpourings of love, the question still remained to be answered. Who hated him enough to kill him? Well, in the confusion of that day, the police did manage to speak with Mabel Norman and conduct a brief on-the-spot interrogation as to what she was doing and where her whereabouts were when Taylor was killed. She seemed to be honest, as far as the investigators could tell. She openly admitted she'd been ransacking the place in search of love letters that she had written to Taylor, desperate to keep him from becoming circulated in the public sphere. Seemed honest enough, but then again, for homicide detectives, everything should be suspect. Because as innocent as her remarks might have seemed, for all they knew, Mabel could have very well been searching for incriminating evidence that linked her to the death. In the initial phase of the investigation, the police did seem to pick up an important lead. They talked with one of William Desmond Taylor's neighbors, a lady named Faith Cole McLean. And Faith told detectives she saw something that startled her at the time of Desmond's death. Now, she admitted she wasn't an expert on ballistics, but she knew that something dramatic had just happened at Desmond's house. As she put it, "I wasn't sure then that it was a shot at all, but I distinctly heard an explosion." Not only that, she may have seen the person behind that explosion. She went on to say, "I glanced out my window and I saw a man leaving the house and going down the walk." And then she paused and said, "Well, I suppose it was a man." Then went on to remark that the character she saw coming out of Desmond's house was rather hard to peg. She remarked about the figure. It was dressed like a man, but, you know, funny looking. Dressed in a heavy coat with a muffler around the chin and a cap pulled down over the eyes. But it walked like a woman. Quick little steps, broad hips, and short legs. Well, this was certainly a better description than they had to start with, but what really got the attention of the investigator's face claimed that immediately before the explosion and the departure of that mysterious figure, she'd actually seen none other than Mabel Norman leaving the residence. And if this wasn't eyebrow-raising enough, according to Faye, she'd also seen Mary Miles Mintner coming and going as well. So with this regular cast of characters running about just prior to his death, there's more than enough suspicion to go around. Investigators followed up with Mabel shortly after this discovery, and once again she appeared to be honest and forthcoming. Said she had been at Desmond's house that night because he had invited her over to give her a gift. And the gift was a new book by none other than Sigmund Freud. Well, now, Desmond Taylor was a man of many interests. He wanted to keep his peers enlightened as well. It was apparently his habit to supply reading material to those who were especially close to him. Nothing at all unusual about that. But police would find evidence that Mabel and Desmond's relationship was far from being just platonic. They'd dig up love letters from Mabel, which were stuffed in all places in Desmond's riding boots. Maybe these were the embarrassing notes Mabel was trying to find on the morning Desmond Taylor turned up dead. Adding to the mystery, police would uncover a secret affair that Taylor was having with a woman named Zelda Crosby, a screenwriter for Famous Players. Intended to contact her, but alarmingly enough, almost right after Desmond died, she was found dead from what was believed to have been a suicide. The mystery around this Hollywood mogul only seemed to grow by the minute, as did the number of suspects. Well, as it pertains to solving the murder of William Desmond Taylor, it wasn't just that there weren't any suspects. It was that there were way too many potential suspects for the police to narrow it down to just one. Any one of his lovers,
or others attached to his levers could have pulled the trigger. And the fact that the only eyewitness was never certain whether the hulking figure seen leaving the residence was a man or a woman kept even the most basic details of a potential assailant entirely obscure. Along with many of these suspects, in the immediate days after William Desmond Taylor's demise, the police were actually swamped with several confessions. Unhinged individuals were calling the police station to claim involvement. Police knew the calls they were getting were mostly just a bunch of cranks, but could one of those cranks have been the actual killer? Another suspect to emerge later on was Taylor's valet driver, Edward F. Sands. It would park cars for Taylor and also did a little more than that. Police came to find out it was Sands who served as a photographer of Desmond's sexual escapades. And police learned that Taylor had fired Sands right before he was murdered. Now, this led the police to the logical suspicion that maybe Sands could have killed his former boss out of anger for being fired. Only trouble was, police had a heck of a time following this raid because shortly after Taylor's death, Sands vanished. And try as they might, they couldn't find any trace of this guy ever again. Which made the situation even more mysterious. Well, in the end, the case went cold. In fact, it still remains unsolved, and it's one of the greatest real-life Hollywood murder mysteries of all time. Man, let's see. Well, let's talk about Christy Johnson. Died in West Hollywood, February 2003. The suspect was Victor Pelagius. Now, she was an aspiring model. Well, at least that's what everybody told her she ought to be. Blessed with stunning looks and a perfect figure, she'd been approached by random people for quite some time who complimented her and even mentioned that perhaps she should give modeling a try. Well, she never took any of these folks seriously. She figured most were just desperate guys looking for a date. But on one particular day, she was out shopping when she bumped into a man who seemed to exude a sense of professionalism and purpose. When he handed her a card and suggested she try out for modeling, she felt his sales pitch was different from the rest. She thought maybe he really meant it. When he mentioned he had a studio in a ritzy section of Hollywood, she was sure he wasn't just some low-life creep with a pickup line. She thought he might be legitimate. So when he suggested they meet up at 10:30 in the morning on Sunday, she decided she'd take him up on the offer. The last soul to see her alive was an elderly couple who lived in the neighborhood of the house where she was visiting for a supposed photo shoot. She was having trouble finding the place and asked an elderly man who'd been roaming around his front yard for directions. Well, originally he had trouble giving them. He was startled by the sudden intrusion and couldn't collect his thoughts well enough to be of much help. But then shortly, the startled man's wife stepped forward and promptly explained that the house she was looking for was the end of the street. And that was the last that anybody in the world of the living would see of Christy Johnson. It later be discovered, Christy met up with a supposed Hollywood agent photographer who went by the name of Victor Thomas. February 15, 2003. The word family and friends notified the police that she hadn't come home after that. She was living with a couple of roommates at the time, and one roommate in particular, Carrie Barish, proved to be particularly helpful to investigators. Upon being questioned, she recalled Christy mentioned she'd come across a man who claimed to be in the filmmaking business, told she'd be auditioning for a part in a new James Bond film. Now that piece of information was important because it later matched the description given by Susan Murphy, another would-be victim who managed to slip out of the maniac's grasp. According to Susan's account, Christy told Carrie that she might be able to make up to $100,000 for the gig. Carrie told investigators Christy bought some very specific articles of clothing for that supposed audition. A white long-sleeve shirt made of very nice soft cotton with a pointed collar, black miniskirt, black pumps with 6-inch stiletto heels, and a pair of sheer pantyhose. These clothes matched up with the same kind of dress that the one that got away, Susan Murphy, was told to wear.
It also helpful to detectives that Carrie Barish recalled that Christie was supposed to meet the Hollywood photographer at a house in Beverly Hills. Police actually issued a public statement a few days after Christie's disappearance. Statement read in part, February 17, 2003. Santa Monica Police Department began a missing persons investigation regarding the disappearance of Christine Louise Johnson. Preliminary investigation has closed that Ms. Johnson was last seen leaving her residence in Santa Monica on the afternoon of February 15th. Well, they described her, they described her car, and where she was going, what she was going to do, and asked for anybody with any information to call the Office of Criminal Investigations tip line. Once she is reported missing, the investigation into her disappearance began. And, of course, police immediately hit a bunch of dead ends and false leads. Looked into several people, including Christie's former boyfriend, but all the usual suspects had rock-solid alibis. And the investigators obviously had no idea that Christie had made the fateful decision to hook up with a stranger. But it would be discovered, though, and tipped off by Christie's friends as to what she's up to, detectives would try to get the word out. Efforts included an article featured in the Los Angeles Times that proclaimed a 21-year-old Santa Monica woman who may have been on the way to Beverly Hills to meet a photographer and that has not been seen for 5 days. Article went on to state that unspecified friends had tipped the police off that Johnson was supposed to meet a photographer, possibly to pose for pictures, on Saturday. Police then got another tip from a woman named Susan Murphy who notified him she too had been propositioned by a Beverly Hills photographer. She'd read the articles and alarmed how similar the details sounded to recent events in her own life. She'd been approached by a random man, propositioned her to model for him, and promised a big payday if she came out to his place in Beverly Hills to audition. She explained how the man had approached her in a very professional manner, stating he could get her a gig to be a James Bond girl. Now, this is in the early 2000s, when James Bond was just then returning to the big screen. Images of her being the next Hollywood vixen immediately flashed before her eyes. For a young woman like Susan, this was like being given a chance of a lifetime. She still wasn't sure if her experience was connected to what she read about the missing woman, but she called the police tip line anyway. And the detectives were glad that she did. Her account seemed like the most promising lead they had. If Susan had actually encountered the same man, they'd not only had a lead, but a direct eyewitness to their person of interest, and soon to be suspect. Fortunately for them, Susan proved to be an excellent eyewitness at that. She described the man as being in his mid to late 30s, blue eyes, curly brown hair, slightly thinning hair, which framed his circular face. He was beardless and sported a baseball cap, and she also mentioned he wore a pair of khakis and stylish brown jacket. The man approached her, she said, and said he was in the employ of a company called Silver Screen Partners, was supposed to be an affiliate of Walt Disney, indicated he thought she'd be good screen material. She remembered the guy said his name was Victor Thomas. Detectives were thankful to get such a promising lead, and they were ready to follow it. But prior to Christie's disappearance, Susan herself had ended up having coffee with the guy who continued to insist she'd be a shoe-in for a new James Bond movie. He even promised her once she was recruited, she'd bag an easy $100,000 for the role. Well, while she was interested, something in the back of her mind made her hesitate. She was overwhelmed with the prospect of a Hollywood celebrity, however. When Victor promised that when she showed up at the studio, he'd be able to personally introduce her to both Sean Connery and Pierce Brosnan. Well, feeling like she shouldn't let such a chance slip through her fingers, she agreed to the audition. That's when Victor became quite specific. He instructed her she needed to wear a black miniskirt that was as short and tight as possible, along with a white button-up shirt, stockings, high heels, and wear her hair in a ponytail. Fortunately for Susan Murphy, she also happened to have a very keen, alert fiancé. After she met with Thomas, she came home and informed her fiancé, Mark Wilson, what had happened. Alarm bells immediately went off in his mind. Susan agreed some aspects of the encounter seemed a little sketchy, but she still wanted to check back with Victor just in case she really could land the role of a lifetime. Well, Mark didn't want her to go, so the two worked out a compromise. She'd show up, but he'd take her and park his car a short distance from the meetup site so that he could keep an eye on the situation. And this proved to be a major step. As planned, Mark dropped Susan off at the site and parked a short distance down the street from the house where the audition was supposed to be. Sue's not wanting to stand around outside in a short miniskirt, ended up defying Victor's instructions of being dressed and ready for rehearsal by wearing cargo pants instead. Had the skirt in a plastic bag with her and figured she'd change into it later if the thing turned out to be legitimate. Stood outside the house, wondering when Victor's car might pull up, when suddenly she heard his voice right in her ear. He said, "This isn't what I told you to wear. I'm going to take you someplace to change." He just popped up out of nowhere, she said, and he walked over and she hadn't even seen him approach. Victor must have seen her startled reaction, prompting Victor to change his approach and suggest let's go somewhere to have a drink and talk about the role to help you get prepared. Put his hand on Susan's shoulders to steer her to a direction he wanted to walk, and she didn't enjoy being pushed around, and said, "I'm not going anywhere until I see some identification." Well, Victor at that point scowled and said he left his ID at home. As Susan tried to pull away, he turned up the heat by challenging her. "You're giving up the opportunity of a lifetime." Well, she wasn't having any of that, so she smarted back, "You know, actually, my safety is much more important." And that seemed to make Victor more determined to get her to go along. He said, "We need to go. We should go and talk with my friend Natasha and talk about the role." Well, up to this point, Susan never heard this guy mention anything about Natasha, and seemed that he was just making stuff up as he went along. She took a few steps back from what she thought was already even a lunatic, and he shouted, "Okay, just forget it. I don't think you're right for the part anyway." Well, at this point, Mark, her fiancé, intervened and pulled his car within a few feet, parked, and got out of the car. Sprinting right up to Victor to confront him, and Susan ran toward her man, just as Victor suddenly bolted in the other direction. Well, Mark and Susan rushed off to the car and began chasing after Victor as he ran on foot. Well, he ran down alleys and behind buildings, and Mark finally managed to corner him. Jumped out of the car and confronted him directly. It's important to note, Mark used to be a cop, and though he's no longer on the force at the time of this encounter, he pretty much behaved as if he was. After getting hold of the man, he patted him down for weapons, and it was once he was confident that the man didn't have a gun. He shouted, "I don't know if I'm going to kill you or drag you to the police station." Well, at that point in time, this Thomas eventually promised he wouldn't entice young ladies again. Well, Susan thought about filing a police report, but she didn't. But when she heard about Christy Johnson's story, she knew she had to come forward. Well, the suspect turned out to be not that hard to track down. His real name was Victor Pelagios. Had a rap sheet verified he used a Hollywood Stick in the past when he was arrested for attempting rape in 1989. Out of time, we'll finish up with some more of the more lurid details of this particular story in our next show. Until then, Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.